Hello, okay. Listeners, and welcome to the latest Dr. Harris podcast. I can't remember what number Dr. Harris podcast it is. I think it's probably number 8, but it might be number 7.
Let's call it 7A then.
Okay, and I'm Julian Lasso, and this is my friend and colleague, Dr. David Hindmarsh.
Okay, I'm very pleased we are to be here with you today.
Yes, and we're going to discuss a range of articles, and it's mostly about COVID again this month, as it has been for the last sort of 3 months. A range of articles relating to what's happening with coronavirus, COVID, and its progression, coming out of lockdown, and you know, what we think is going to happen from here on in, and what seems to have happened up to this point, as far as we've been able to find medical articles about it. So we've got articles drawn from a variety of sources, but as usual from the BMJ, and then I've got one from the Observer, and then there's one from Digital Health. We're going to start with this one from the Observer, which was originally published on Sunday the 31st of May. And this is called, well, it's COVID-19 expert Carl Friesten says Germany may have more immunological dark matter. So I mean, what we're up to now with COVID seems to be that lots of people in the medical profession are kind of thinking to themselves, This is a second wave just waiting to happen.
Yes, that's true. Yeah,
because we've had, we're coming out of lockdown.
Yes,
or we seem to be coming out of lockdown a bit more almost every day. They seem to be announcing, right, okay, now you can do this, now you can do
yes,
that.
Yes, precisely. It's not just one. Here's the plan for the next 2 months or something.
Yeah, and that's part of the issue, that it's quite confusing.
It is confusing. Yeah.
So new announcements all the time, and the kind of confusion that we've been suffering all the way through COVID has now been spread out to the rest of the public.
Yes.
It did have a comparatively simple set of guidelines to follow, and now they've got sort of you can be in a sort of COVID relationship with another household, and you know, you can see your friends for a barbecue, but it has to be socially up to a certain number of people.
Yes,
it has to be socially distanced, and it's already very confusing.
Yes, so it is confusing.
The confusion is one issue. But then on top of the confusion, there's the breakdown of trust in the government's handling of coronavirus in general, but in particular, the Dominic Cummings business, which, you know, has led to a lot of people, I think, thinking, well, if Dominic Cummings could drive all the way to Durham and basically do whatever he likes in defiance of government guidelines, why should any of the rest of us take any notice of government guidelines?
Yeah.
And there certainly has been, we've had a number of weekends with nice weather.
Yes.
Where people have been out flocking to beaches, flocking to parks in large numbers and, you know, don't appear to have been observing social distancing very carefully in a lot of cases.
That's true,
So, and then on top of that, you've had the Black Lives Matter business, which in the last couple of weeks has blown up into a number of massive demonstrations in the UK as well as abroad.
Yes.
And again, you know, social distancing, some of the people in those crowds may have been observing social distancing, but for sure, a lot of them weren't.
The majority will be very close together for quite long periods of time.
So when you take all those things in combination, you would expect to see, looking at the figures, that not that they would be continuing to decline.
No, that's true. You'd think they would be going up,
You'd think they would either be increasing a bit or possibly increasing quite sharply as a result of all these people being in close proximity to each other for quite long periods of time. But that doesn't seem to be happening. The official figures are still the number of new cases per day is going down. The number of people in hospital with confirmed coronavirus is going down.
Yes, yeah.
And the number of deaths from coronavirus is going down. Mm. And that's in spite of more testing than at any previous stage. Mm. So it seems to be almost in defiance of the logic of the situation. Yes.
Is it spreading to different areas of the country? Is it getting? Are you getting higher levels in, you know, up north? And
well, there's certainly been when the idea was that all the schools were going to go back about a week ago, there was certainly a lot of protesting from the northeast. I think it was because they seem to be, you know, the R rate has been sort of below. The R rate in one part of the country, I think it was the northeast, might have been the northwest, but it was hovering about one.
Yeah.
Whereas in other, and in, I think in sort of Cornwall, it was also sort of a bit higher than the rest of the country, where it's been kind of 0.7 to 0.9.
Right.
So there have certainly been areas of the country that have been getting more cases than other areas of the country.
Yes,
And in fact, if you look at the graphs that they show on those COVID updates or coronavirus updates in the afternoons, it always looks to me as if Wales isn't doing very well, because their sort of figures for hospital admissions and deaths and things just seem to be flat instead of coming down. They just seem to have reached a certain level and just gone flat. Mm. But by and large, it's all still coming down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's something.
And that's where this article from the Observer comes in. Mm. So this was an interview with this guy Carl Freeston, who's a member of the Independent Sage Group.
Oh yes.
So Sage is the group that advises the government. It's scientific advisory, something or other.
Yes.
I can't remember what the G and the E stand for. No. And there's an Independent Sage Group, which is another sort of think tank, which doesn't advise the government, and it's kind of like an alternative view of things.
You know, you can get Purple Sage as well.
Yeah, I tell you. Yes. That's very nice. Yeah. I don't think that's in this group.
Oh, isn't it? Oh.
But and what this guy is saying, but I mean, the dark matter bit is really just one small paragraph in this interview, which is largely, I mean, this guy is, he's not an epidemiologist, he's a statistician.
Right.
So he does kind of data modelling.
Yes.
And he's saying that you can predict the progress of the epidemic using these data modelling things.
Yes.
But he's also saying, what he's saying is that the kind of the sort of old school way of predicting the outcome is to try to take all the information that you've got, and, you know, the sort of follow the logic of what the outcomes are likely to be, and predict, you know, our case is going to go up, our case is going down.
Yes.
And the other way of doing it is instead of attempting to assume that you know everything, to just look at the overall pattern, which is rather what they do in chaos theory, I think, instead of trying to actually know the intricacies of what's going on inside the process, just look at the overall pattern and try to project from that what's happening.
Yes.
And he's saying, so the majority of this interview is given over to that, to talking about, first of all, what's the point of having an independent SAGE committee?
Yes.
And secondly, his ideas about data modelling and, you know, how it's actually quite good at predicting what's going to happen at every stage of the epidemic.
Yeah.
But then he also mentions that this dark matter idea, and that's the one that's kind of seems to have caught on. Mm. So what he's saying is basically that the dark matter idea was taken from physics, where back in the sort of 1940s, 1950s or whenever it was, when the scientists were looking at the behaviour of the universe, and they looked at, you know, all of the known matter in the universe and all of the known forces in the universe and, you know, the known laws of the universe and put them together to model the behaviour of the universe, there seemed to be something missing.
Right.
There wasn't sufficient
matter
in the universe to explain the way in which it was actually behaving.
Yeah.
So they said there must be something else called dark matter.
Right.
And the dark matter idea with reference to, you know, and it subsequently turned out that there is something else called dark matter, right. And they're now starting to understand what it is.
Right.
So the dark matter idea with respect to coronavirus is, if you look at the sort of the things we know about coronavirus, you know, human behaviour and how contagious it is, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
At this stage, it ought to be going up, not down.
Yes.
And also, you've got these weird disparities, like how come Germany's got such low incidence rates?
Yes.
And, you know, some countries have very high incidence rates, other countries have very low incidence rates.
Yes.
And what he's suggesting is, you know, there are other factors at play here that we don't fully understand yet.
Well, it's probably sausages that I would
sausages.
Think.
Well, that would explain the German thing.
Right, of course, yeah.
Yes. So it may. I mean, it may be that that there's more kind of resistance to COVID out there than we think.
Well, it's possible. Yes, it is possible. So it could be genetic, I suppose.
Possibly, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that some people are more likely to come to harm.
Yes.
I.e. the BAME community.
Yes.
And a lot of that seems to be linked to the fact they're more, they tend to be more socially deprived.
Yes.
But even allowing for social deprivation.
Yes.
If you look at sort of the way to which people who are working in medical health react to the virus, the BAME community seem to be disproportionately, you know, at risk from it.
Yes, it's true. Yeah.
So so it does seem that there might be something genetic going on there as well as the social deprivation thing.
But why men then, do you think? You know, because men are more likely to die from COVID.
Well,
than,
I don't know. It's just
maybe it's just because they're, you know...
Because God's a woman.
That's it, yes. But I suppose, you know, we're sort of 10 years ahead of the queue for women for heart attacks.
Well, so 10 years ahead of the queue for women?
Yeah.
I'm certainly...
Yeah. I don't mean four. I mean
right at the front of the queue.
Yeah, we're at the front of the queue from a heart attack thing.
Right.
And the women are behind us.
Well, it's true that men are likely to die earlier, just in general.
Yes, that's true.
It?
Yes, so it is.
I suppose it's.
Yeah, but it is. Yeah, maybe that some of it is related to the complications of.
Yes.
Of the, you know, because weight is one of those things, and women are usually very slim.
Yes, except those who aren't. it could easily be that, yeah.
Or smoking and drinking.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite possible.
Yeah.
You never know.
But, I mean, the you know, the presumption, as I said to you when we were talking about this a couple of days ago, when you know, at the beginning of the coronavirus, the presumption was a blank slate. Everybody, there's no defence against this virus. It's
true.
A new virus.
Yes,
nobody has got any defence against it.
Yeah.
Given a free run, if we don't get lockdowns and things, given a free run, everybody will catch it at some stage.
Yes.
You know, so if you let it romp through society, that's exactly what it will do.
Yes.
And it does it, it's, the way it's playing out, it's a bit more nuanced than that, or so it would appear.
Yeah.
That some populations, some areas, some people are more susceptible to it than others.
Yes.
Certainly some people get sicker with it than others,
yes,
but it also seems that some people are more likely to catch it than others.
Yes, because children are under 14 or something, or under 13, are less likely to, you know, less likely to die from it.
Yeah,
definitely.
But are they less likely to actually catch it?
Well, that's a good question.
It's very difficult to quantify all that because we don't.
We're not sure about the figures.
The testing is less than 100%.
Yes.
And the reliability of the testing is a lot less than 100%.
Well, that's true. Yes.
So, I mean, that's that dark matter thing, which is just an idea, really. It's just this kind of emerging idea that there might be, and there might not be any substance to it, but it's the idea that there might be something else going on out there that is preventing COVID from, it seems to have sort of reached a certain point, and even though the conditions are right for it to create a second wave now, that doesn't seem to be happening.
No.
And there may be some as yet undiscovered reason for that.
So what are you saying? Are you saying because there's it's not following the pattern, then there must be something else going on.
Well, there might be something else going on. I mean, this is his idea. That's where the dark matter idea comes from.
Yes.
But there's some unexplained element at work. And then the second one we were going to look at was this this thing about all-cause mortality.
Yes.
This is a proper BMJ research paper.
The Italian one, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. So let's just give the reference for this. This is BMJ M1835, and it's called Use of All-Case Mortality to Quantify the Consequences of COVID-19 in Nembro, Lombardy.
Yeah.
So Lombardy, you've covered up the microphone.
Yeah, sorry.
The Lombardy is sort of northern Italy.
Yes.
So that's where they had this sort of tremendous outbreak that was like the first sort of epicenter of it in Europe, really, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And for that reason, I suppose, because they were a bit ahead of the rest of the curve in northern Italy in particular, they're now a bit ahead of the rest of Europe in actually starting to put together statistics for what happened during the worst of the outbreak.
Right, yeah.
And this study was basically looking at the death rates.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
In this place called Nembro, this little Nembro had 11,505 residents as of 1st of January 2020.
Yeah.
So what they've looked at is the all-cause mortality rates
over a period of years, didn't they?
Yeah. But to kind of find out what would your average death rate be.
Yes.
At this time of year,
yes.
In non-COVID years,
yes.
And then they've compared that with the death rate during the coronavirus period, sort of going through to April, I think.
Yeah, that's right. They're saying it was 10 per 1,000 people at the beginning, and then maximum of 21 per 1,000 person years.
That's
all causes.
That was before it got started.
Yeah.
And then in March 2020, monthly all-cause mortality reached a peak of 154.4 per 1,000 person years.
And then
I struggle a bit to get my head around the 1,000 person years thing. But...
Yes, yeah, it's a tricky one. Let's forget about that. The observed increase in mortality was driven especially by... especially men from until the only 85 confirmed deaths in April from COVID, 166 deaths from all causes observed in that period.
What's a little bit frustrating about this is that what you would like, what I would particularly like to see from this study is kind of a little graph that shows, okay, here are the normal average deaths during the period February to the end of April in a normal year.
Yes, yes.
Here are the deaths from confirmed COVID cases February to April this year.
Yes.
And here is the all-cause mortality figure February to April this year, because it's the disparity in many ways between the COVID deaths, confirmed COVID deaths, and all cause mortality, which is the interesting bit.
Yes,
mortality could have gone up during the COVID period for other reasons than people catching coronavirus itself.
It is possible.
Because, you know, people might be not coming forward with heart failure, for example, because they don't want to go to the hospital.
That's true. Yeah, I think they mention that in this article.
Yeah.
They said access to medical care, not wanting to go to hospital.
Yes.
And the fact that the hospitals were overwhelmed, weren't
they?
Yeah,
so,
And the staff were affected as well. So state of emergency, patients needing immediate intensive care, the emotional pressure on medical teams, shortage of materials, human resources, clinical complexity of the disease. So it must have been horrendous, I should think.
Well, yeah. So the hospitals were really struggling to cope, in other words. And even if you did go there with a heart attack, your chances of getting decent you know, a normal standard of clinical care for your condition would probably greatly reduced because they were so overwhelmed with COVID cases.
Yes, that's true. Interestingly, I think they're still isolating in parts of Italy where you might have a mother or a father a few streets away, but if it's more than so many metres, you're not allowed to go and visit them.
Really? I mean, there's a couple of startling graphs in here. There's a particularly good one where this one here, monthly all-cause mortality. Yeah. Going back to 2012, and it's just kind of a little bar chart showing the bars all about, just kind of pootling along at the bottom of the graph until you get to, that's March 2020, and all of a sudden it shoots right up in the air, right up to 160 from something like sort of 20.
Yeah.
So it really that gives you an idea of the impact that COVID had. It just went right off the chart in the course of that 1 month.
Yes,
and so I mean, if this plays out across the whole of Europe or across the UK, or the world, I suppose, then I suppose what we're basically saying is that there are probably far more deaths from the COVID crisis than you get from looking at the I mean, our current death statistics just show people who have been confirmed with COVID and have subsequently died.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think it's the same thing we're saying here, that actually some of the tests might have come in positive after the statistics were looked at. And whether the disease is actually cause of death or whether it's
contributory factor.
What does it say up here? Conclude that this rapid increase in deaths is attributable to the COVID pandemic. Only about half of the deaths observed since the pandemic
Were categorised as confirmed COVID.
Yes, yeah.
So
that's the categorising is exactly part of the issue, isn't it?
And so there will be other stuff in there. There will be people killing each other at home as a result of lockdown and domestic violence.
There will be people killing themselves at home as well.
Yes, and there will be heart attacks who don't go to the hospital or go to the hospital and not get properly looked after.
Yes, exactly.
But the chances are that the real sort of impact of COVID, the real numbers of people dying from COVID or because COVID is contributing to their death is going to be much higher than what we're now estimating it at.
Yes.
So this is, this is going to be the first of many such studies coming out, I expect, as time goes by.
Yeah. COVID will still be twice as high as the number of confirmed deaths. From this study sheds light on the scale of the problem, erroneously not being attributed to COVID, not being tested.
Yes, of course. Yeah, the issue of people who die outside hospital without ever having been tested, which of course is an issue in this country as well.
Despite being weakened by a substantial reduction in public health funding in the past decade, the Italian's healthcare system overall performance still ranks high in international comparisons. I think there's some complaints about our public health not being very well funded.
Are there?
Well, I believe so.
I haven't heard that. Well, that brings us nicely onto the next article, which is an article in the BMJ about the test and trace service. Now, there have been a lot of articles in the BMJ about the test and trace, and you and I sort of independently looked at several of them. But in the most recent BMJ, there's this rather good article about what's the matter with it, basically. Quite a lot of them are trying to explain how it works. And this is called Too Slow and Fundamentally Flawed, Why Test and Trace is a Weak and Inequitable Defence Against COVID-19. And this is a news article as opposed to a research article.
Right.
The reference is BMJ M 2246. And I mean, what they start off by saying is that basically it's too slow. So yes. The ideally, if you're going to have test and trace, what you want is a turnaround of 24 hours between somebody being identified as COVID,
or positive,
the people who they've been in contact with
yes.
being contacted
yes.
And said, you've got to self-isolate.
Yes.
And what's happening here is that, for a start, your swab result isn't coming back within 24 hours.
No, it's at least 48 hours, isn't it?
Well, they're saying anecdotally it's 2 to 3 days. Mm. And they go into this business about, funding to Public Health England being not so good is part of the reason. But it's also partly because what they're suggesting here is that it's also partly because they've tried to do it centrally,
yes,
rather than through local labs.
Yes, precisely.
So that they quote a guy from one of the hospitals in London. I think it's the Francis Crick Institute in London, who's saying, we can turn things over really immediately because we've got these nice little van runs and things in place to get the samples in here nice and quickly, and then we turn it around and get the results back out nice and quickly.
Yes.
If there's a problem, I know everybody in the supply chain as it is. I pick up a phone and talk to them, and we can sort out logistic difficulties very quickly because we've got good communications in place.
Yeah.
So we're the approach that the government have taken is to sort of set up everything from scratch.
And private businesses, aren't they, as well?
Well, there's quite a lot of sort of things being sent through the post and, so it's just much slower.
Yes.
And they're saying that... So Alan Wilson is president of the Institute of Biomedical Science, whose members include the scientists running the NHS pathology labs. He says, we've always argued that testing would be better done locally because the infrastructure exists already. Why invent another route?
Yes.
The government decided early on that their preference was to develop separate labs. I think it was a political rather than clinical decision.
Yeah.
So that decision has, slowed things down.
Yeah.
But they're also saying that you need the right equipment and you need the right sort of plastic tubes, probes, robotic testing platforms. There are compatibility issues.
Right.
You need a printer cartridge. You need the right module for a particular platform.
Yes.
And there's no manufacturer or little manufacturing capacity for these modules in the UK.
Right.
So it all has to come from overseas,
problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's
it's a bit like the masks in Korea.
Yeah.
They ran out of masks, so they just made them all in their country.
Yeah.
They set it up in no time as
But that's what we haven't been able to do in the UK.
No.
And when in the early stages of the coronavirus crisis, where it was all kind of, ramping it up and rolling it out, we're going to be doing more and more testing.
Yes.
But we've got problems because we can't get the agent, the clinical chemical agents or reagents that are needed. And a lot of that was down to the fact that there's no manufacturing base for this kind of thing in this country. It's all bought in from abroad.
Yeah.
And the reason there's no manufacturing base in this country is because the government has made privatising decisions right down the line about, that's all right, we'll get that stuff, we won't do it ourselves, we'll just buy it, it's cheaper.
Yes.
Well, so, go figure.
It's a bit like that thing about, drug supplies, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
It's that same issue that we're not producing them. And a lot of our blood products are not produced in this country. And anyway.
So my blood, for example, I've had to buy it in from abroad.
Have you? Well, that's what comes of being from Transylvania.
But the other thing they said is they say in here, which is very interesting, is the case for case finding.
Yes.
So what they're saying is, so the government's model for tracking and tracing or testing and tracing is that you find your patient who's a confirmed case of COVID, and then you interview that patient to find out who are all the people that they've been in contact with in sort of a close environment for more than 15 minutes,
yes.
and then you contact all those people and you tell them to self-isolate.
Yes.
Now, what they're saying in here is that with case finding, you take a very different approach by saying, I'm going to test everybody potentially infected. So if you have one kid infected, you might want to go and test the whole class or even the whole school. So instead of sort of saying, okay, who are all the people you were in contact with, you do this kind of, right, let's test the whole of Norwich, or let's test the whole of this school, let's test the whole of this building, let's test the whole of this neighbourhood.
Yes.
And then you've got
a good picture then. Yeah,
So if you look at the best contact tracing systems, they're doing case finding, citing an example from South Korea, where an outbreak in a call centre in a tower block resulted in 1,143 being tested, of whom 97 were positive.
Right.
So investigators identified asymptomatic carriers who would not have reported themselves under the English system.
Yes, right. That's interesting, isn't it?
So there are...
Yeah.
It's just a different way of doing it. It's going to be more thorough.
So how many of them were asymptomatic? What proportion does it say?
It says, no, it doesn't say how many.
Okay. Interesting though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So they got 97 positive out of 1,400 or something.
Yeah, out of 1,143.
Right.
So what they're saying is you have to test more widely than known contacts to really start finding how many cases there are out there.
Well, I think in Germany there were lots of different labs all over Germany, weren't there? So there was a lot more local facility, I think. Yeah.
That was in a previous article that we looked at, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, and he's saying that the things like the return to schools should be dependent on the level of infections in a particular area.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
And case finding in the area is the first step to establishing what your local levels are. So at the moment, we are reliant on a limited exhortation to people to get in touch if they've got symptoms and come forward to testing.
Yes.
So it's not going out looking for cases. No. It's relying on people to come forward if they're feeling iffy.
Yes.
And of course, that's always a bit dodgy.
Yes. So what happens to people that end up, you know, being sent to hospital where they would get tested? Is that information passed on to public health then? So that you can get an idea.
So that you can do the
tracing from that.
I suppose. Mm. I guess so. So, yeah. So, and then, I mean, the other thing is that it's, at the end of this article, they get into talking about the disproportionate impact. Mm. So the poorer parts of society is the most exposed.
Yes.
To the test and trace system widens health inequalities because it's easiest for the people who are middle class to comply with self-isolation.
Yes.
And hardest for people who are A, poor, B, living in more crowded conditions.
Yes.
So it's in the poorer areas, the poorer parts of society, that it's going to be most difficult to stop COVID from popping up again. Yeah. And it's disproportionately sort of risky for the poorer members of society.
Yes, yeah.
So there's that, but there's also the question of the app.
Yes.
Which was supposed to be part of this world-beating... test and trace system, and the app has just completely disappeared off the landscape.
Has it not been commented on anymore at all?
Well, I mean, as far as I know, we're supposed to have the app by now.
Yes.
Yeah. We were supposed to have this world-class test and trace system in place by the 1st of June, and the app was supposed to be part of that, and then they stopped kind of saying dates for the app, and now they've just completely stopped talking about the app so they've just put the app on the back burner, and
the app is dependent on people saying I've got COVID.
I think so. I think it's dependent first of all on people getting the app, downloading the app, and getting it on their mobile phones.
So you can find hot areas in the country, partly, is it?
Well, that's the idea, is that if somebody who's got the app puts onto their phone the information that they have got COVID,
yes,
then all the other people who've got the app,
yes,
their phones will tell them, you know, when they're in proximity to the phone of this person who's got COVID. That's as I understand
right,
it.
Right.
So it's supposed to be, you know,
yeah,
geographically sensitive to yes, where the cases of COVID are.
Right.
And that means you can steer clear of them kind
yes,
of thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as I understand it, it's founded on a couple of things. There were sort of different versions of the app. Right. The NHS was trying to develop their own.
Yes, yeah.
And then Google and probably Apple, I think, but so certainly a couple of different sort of big international tech companies
yes,
were coming forward with their own mm, versions of apps.
Mm.
And they worked in different ways. Mm. So the NHS one seemed to be saving all the, saying that we're going to save all the details yes, of people who've got COVID
yeah,
to a central database.
Yeah.
And we'll contact other people who might have been in contact with them using the information on the central database.
Yes.
And the ones from the tech companies seem to be saying, you know, there won't be any central database.
No.
The information will be in people's phones
yes,
and the way that they communicate with yes, each other. It yeah, won't be held centrally by
no,
a central agency. No. So there were yeah, squabbles over the privacy aspect of it.
Yeah.
But I think there was also something I read in one of the newspapers or in digital health or something about the fact that it would only work if you had your app switched on,
right?
On your phone,
right?
So even if you had it on your phone,
yeah,
it might not necessarily work 100% of the time.
No,
if you didn't have that app sort of up and running.
No.
So
the other thing is, if they get telephone calls from this centre somewhere and say, "Oh, you've been in contact with someone who's got COVID, you've got to self isolate for 2 weeks."
Yes.
And they say, "Oh yeah, all right." And then they'll go off down the pub.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's similar to the quarantine thing, isn't
yes,
it?
Yeah.
I mean, the problem with the argument about quarantine is...
Well, people coming into the country,
yes,
you mean?
I mean, one of the arguments about that is that if people are coming into the country from abroad,
yes,
the chances are there's a lower infection rate abroad than there is in the UK.
Yeah.
So,
at the moment, yeah.
So what are we quarantining them for? Because they're less likely to infect us than...
Well, I think when it was starting, I think they were saying that quite a lot of the cases had probably come
from abroad,
but that doesn't, not really...
So if somebody's coming into the UK now from Brazil,
yes,
that's one thing, but if they're coming from Germany,
yes,
the chance that we're more likely to be giving the COVID to them than they
yes,
are giving it to us.
Well, that's why the Spanish don't want us going on holiday.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but,
fair enough.
But the other argument about it is that the quarantine that they've put in place
yes,
is you've got to tell us where you're going to be self-isolating for 2 weeks.
Yes.
So there's no, then it's not right. If you come into the UK, you've got to stay in a hotel airport for 2 weeks and we're going to be keeping an eye on you.
Yeah.
It's you know, you nominate somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, and if the place you nominate is, you know, I'm coming into Gatwick Airport, but I live in Wales,
yes,
I'm going to be driving home to Wales and self-isolate. Yes.
Going into garages for petrol.
It's
and,
Dominic yeah, Cummings style
yeah,
self-isolation.
Yes.
So yeah, it's basically... valueless, yeah, really.
But it's in Korea, they enforced it, didn't they? They said, if you don't do it, we're going to charge you £6,000, which is a huge amount of money.
They, yes.
Or you can go to prison for a year, if you like.
Yeah, not just coming into the country, but if they said
no,
you've got to self-isolate.
People, yeah, exactly.
You've
yes,
got to self-isolate.
You've got to, yes.
Yeah.
And then they only had something like 300 deaths or something, didn't they?
Well, we've got a thing about Korea. Can the UK emulate South Korea's approach
right,
to COVID-19?
Yeah.
Another article from the BMJ.
Yeah.
And this is...
I think they basically said no, didn't they?
M2084.
Yes.
Yes, they did basically say no. And I think that part of the reason why they said... Well, part of the reason is because we haven't got the app.
Mm, yeah,
we haven't got a yeah, working app.
Yeah.
It's also because, you know, the kind of... I think the privacy thing features much less highly on the South Korean list of priorities than it does in the UK.
Yeah.
And so therefore, they've done things like accessing people's financial transactions.
Yes.
So they don't. They in order to track them, they've done a certain amount of looking at when they've taken money out of the bank and where they've done that
that's
from
true.
That
yes.
kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as you say, they've done they've been much more kind of rigorous about saying, if we say you've got to isolate yourself, you've got to isolate yourself. Otherwise, it's a great big fine, or you can go to prison.
Yeah.
Violation of quarantine regulations is a criminal offence and can result in a fine of up to 10 million won, which is £6,600 or €7,400 or $8,100 or a year in prison.
Yes, right.
So enforcement of isolation helped South Korea avoid full lockdown, and society is now starting to return to normal.
Yeah, it's a big difference, isn't it? But weren't they good at it, and it was all organised because they'd had experiences before?
Yes. Because they've had SARS and stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So and they knew what they were doing.
Yes.
And they knew what worked as well.
Yeah, the government encouraged widespread wearing of face masks.
Yes. See, so why are we doing that? They're just saying, oh, use it if you're going on the bus.
Yeah. To ensure adequate supplies, the Korean government took control of the manufacture of face masks and implemented mandatory public procurement measures.
Yeah.
Telemonitoring services were established for patients who were unwell in the community. Swab testing was accelerated through innovation, such as positive pressure testing booths.
So see, that would be an interesting thing.
Yeah.
That's what a friend of ours was wanting to do.
Yes, Hans, you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah so... the closed positive pressure environment produced protected testers who only had to replace their gloves between patients, cutting swabbing times to around 1 minute each. I mean, they just had much more swabbing and testing capacity right from the word go.
Yeah.
They've been much better at identifying cases, rigorously isolating them, stopping them from spreading, and just kept it under control right from the off.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think it's too late for us to be thinking of getting anywhere. And aren't they saying something about how their technology is so much better than ours as well?
Right, they probably are saying that. Damn them.
Mobile phones in particular.
Damn them.
They're very, very clever.
They make us look like idiots. The other thing that's quite interesting is I was talking to you about this isn't in one of our sort of medical summaries, but Tim Winch, our regular locum, was saying, why is it that the death rate in Britain seems to be higher than the death rate in other countries,
Spain, for instance,
other European countries, but countries with a similar sort of population profile.
Yes.
And I said to you that what we haven't seen an awful lot about sort of until today or yesterday when this thing about dexamethasone suddenly came out.
Yes.
There hasn't been very much about, treatment regimes for COVID, has there?
It's been
the sort of blank slate thing, hasn't it? It's been, well, basically, it's a new virus, so therefore there is no treatment.
Yes.
And there's the hydroxychloroquine thing, which is basically consisted of everybody saying, hydroxychloroquine won't do you any good, it'll probably kill you.
Yes.
Everybody apart from Donald Trump.
Yes, yeah.
But what we haven't seen any sort of comparisons. I mean, so my understanding of hospital treatment is we'll get you into hospital and kind of keep an eye on you, give you oxygen, if necessary, stick you on a respirator. That's about as much as we can do for you, basically, and hope you pull through.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen any comparisons with whether other countries are doing exactly the same thing or whether they've got different treatment regimes.
Yeah, it's difficult to know, isn't it? I don't think there is any clear... We haven't got any clear information about that.
No.
And I think there's all the sort of new ideas about complications like the DVTs and the, you know, myocarditis, all sorts of various different things that we haven't even thought about. And where's the, you know, maybe, you know, if, I suppose if you're in hospital with the clever doctors in hospital, they'll know what to do about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because they're clever.
Yes. Or at least you hope they are.
Well, I hope so. Yes.
So,
Yes,
well, I think we've probably, how much time have we done?
We've easily done an hour.
Yeah, okay, well.
Yeah, we better stop it now. We've got them to get falling asleep.
Okay, 45 minutes that is. Okay, well, I think that'll probably do us. So we'll say thank you very much to everybody for listening.
Yes, well done.
And, speak to you next time.
Yeah.